So good morning, Dr. Perlstein.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So we are here today with a priest, a rabbi, and a physician, minus the priest, as our beloved Father Anderson is on a mission trip. I believe he has finished in Ecuador, and now he is in Panama. But we wish him all the best. But we are in now episode number 2, kind of a continuation of our previous conversation that we had about religion and medicine, and kind of looking at some of the pitfalls, some of the experience that you have with just shy of 4 decades of experience here and in the field of medicine.
You had to rub in that 4 decades of experience, didn't you? Yeah.
I did.
You know, I have now houseplants older than some of my colleagues.
Sure. You know, but it's I think we're fascinated with the connections to religion and certainly the practice of medicine. For as we know, you know, religion obviously and the experience, spirituality, and everything else is thousands and thousands of years old. As we know that the practice of medicine is probably just as old as the beginning of time. That we know, especially from a Judaic perspective, we know that medicine has always been a definitive and a pinnacle moment within religious faith in terms of how do we access, how do we support those in our midst that are ill, that are suffering, to alleviate the pain and the stress, not only on the body, but certainly on the family as well.
Agreed. Greece and Persia,
mm-hmm.
Hippocrates,
mm-hmm.
father of medicine,
mm-hmm.
and Persia, which is now modern-day Iran.
Mm-hmm.
That's where modern medicine actually started.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Let's talk about it a little bit.
And just to, just because we didn't get a chance to do this in the last episode, but the medical insignia. Why the snake?
Let's talk about the snake.
So that may have to, just for our listeners, and I only mention this just because from a Judaic perspective, we actually engaged in this last week with the Torah portion looking at Miriam and being afflicted, and effectively God and Moses coming together and having this snake that would heal, this golden snake that would heal those that were ill. And in terms of the connections to the medical insignia, how it's been accessed and kind of
That's the teaser. Stay tuned for the show. Maybe we'll explain that.
Absolutely. So we wish you a wonderful day and enjoy the podcast.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the program hosts and their guests and are not necessarily those of WSTU, St. Mary's Episcopal Church, and Temple Beit Haim. Products that may be mentioned are not necessarily intended as an endorsement. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited. And now, WSTU presents a priest and a rabbi. Call in with questions and comments at 220-9788. 220-WSTU. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, Stuart, Florida. We are here this morning, minus a priest. So it is a physician and a rabbi on part 2 of our segment on religion and medicine. When did the two converge? When did they diverge? What is some of the history involved in decisions that are made through medicine and decisions that might be made through religion? So it is with great pleasure that I introduce and welcome back Dr. Ira Perlstein, who is here to join us this morning.
Well, thank you very much, and it is a beautiful morning here, and I understand you're out of here for the weekend, doing a little bit of traveling. Why don't you tell us what you're headed to do?
Absolutely. So every year we are very fortunate to be able to be on faculty at Camp Coleman in Cleveland, Georgia. Some may not be familiar with where that is, because it is in the middle of nowhere.
But it's the better Cleveland.
It is the better Cleveland. It is about an hour and a half north of Atlanta, 2 hours north of Atlanta, and my wife and I will be bringing our kids for them to experience Jewish summer life, Jewish summer camping, and be able to be on faculty and to teach and to inspire and bring just a great amount of joy. So we are very excited. We're going to be going off to that wonderful hot place called Hotlanta tomorrow. Drive as best as I can. I'm one of these people that I say to my wife, go to the bathroom now, because the next time we will do any pit stops is 440 miles from now, when my car reaches empty, and to fill up again. So we are we'll be on faculty for about a week, and then back into it.
Yeah, North Georgia is beautiful, and certainly Cleveland rocks, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's funny. I was talking to my kids about it because my kids are like really excited, and I said, you know, just to be aware that, you know, it's like 15 degrees cooler in Northern Georgia than it is down here. And my oldest daughter looked and said, "Thank goodness, because Dad, it's like 105 degrees." And I go, "It's not 105. It's 97, and at night, it will go down to a very cool 94. But we are very excited, very excited. And for you, Dr. Perlstein, any plans over the next couple of weeks?
No plans for the next couple of weeks. Hopefully by the end of August, we're going to be traveling a little bit. We're thinking about spending some time in Asheville, North Carolina, one of our favorite cities. Mm. Asheville is absolutely beautiful. Cool mountain nights.
I've heard it is quite a foodie town.
It is a foodie mm-hmm. town, and I'm kind of a foodie.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. Oh, well, so, you know, as we unpack kind of today, just maybe, Dr. Perlstein, just to go a little bit into your background. For those that may not be aware, Dr. Ira Perlstein, he is also, has started a practice, Preserve Health MD, which is more of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in terms of more of concierge medicine.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of a misnomer. Concierge tends to give the opinion or expresses that it's for the wealthy, and it's not for the wealthy. Mm-hmm. What I really have is a DPC practice. DPC is direct primary care. Some people call it direct patient care. Hmm. And what that means is, it's old-fashioned medicine. Hmm. I contract directly with the patient for fee-for-service. Mm-hmm. We don't bill their insurance. There's an unlimited amount of visits. It's sort of like it was in the olden days. When I was growing up, you didn't have health insurance. You had what was called a major medical policy. Hmm. And major medical would cover your hospitalizations. If you went to the doctor, you paid the doctor a fair and reasonable fee. The difference between what I do and that old style of charging the patient is I have a monthly membership fee. Mm-hmm. And that membership fee, which is based on area demographics, allows the patient to have unlimited amount of visits, unlimited amount of phone calls, for that month. Mm-hmm. And that fee is the same month after month.
Oh, well.
We don't increase it very much. I've increased my prices one time over the last 4 years.
Oh, well. So just to go back a little bit, so you grew up in Columbia, South Carolina.
Columbia, South Carolina. Talking about a hot town, heat-wise, not a lot to do then.
Oh, well.
There. But Columbia is a nice city now. The University of South Carolina is there.
Mm-hmm.
They have a medical school there.
And you attended medical school in Charleston.
In Charleston at Medical University of South Carolina. I graduated medical school in 1984.
Oh, wow.
George Orwell's year.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I remember that book,
1984. I won't say that in 1984 I was in...
I don't even want to hear it.
I was in first grade.
Because my radio show, which mm-hmm. I'm starting next week on this very same station,
mm.
my colleague on that show, Dr. Leanne Talton, she's 35 years old.
Oh, well. Well.
So I was practicing before she was born.
Mm-hmm. Which must that must be a really interesting dynamic. Given somebody who is a little bit younger and given the experience, but looking at that wide range of ability in terms of accessing medicine.
We have houseplants older than she is.
Wow. So
there is an interesting dynamic with a lot of bantering that we're going to do during that show.
Oh, that's great. So hopefully our listeners will tune into your show. I know it will prove to be successful, and I know I will listen, which would be great.
I love your show.
Thank you. Thank you. So, and of course, to our listeners out there, any questions you have on medicine and religion, please give us a call, 772-220-9788. That's 220-9788. So just to go back on your experiences in medical school in Charleston, because for those of our listeners that might not be aware, and this may be a little heavily Judaically centered, but Charleston has one of the oldest synagogues in the country. Right in downtown Charleston.
Charleston is the oldest reformed mm-hmm. Jewish community in the continental United States.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So when you were in medical school, did you have the opportunity to see the synagogue or?
I did. My family who lived in Charleston were one of the founding families.
Oh, wow.
Of that synagogue.
Wow.
And there are three synagogues in Charleston, or there may be more now, mm-hmm. but back then there were three. There was an Orthodox community, there was a conservative community, and a very large reformed community.
Interesting. And for those of our listeners that are out there, and if you happen to make travel plans and you happen to go out to Charleston, you definitely, it is a National Historic Site, KKBI, that is located right in the heart of downtown Charleston. Just an amazing city. It is one of those cities in the United States that I firmly believe is in the top three. It is an amazing and charming and just romantic city. If you ever had the opportunity, go see Charleston.
Yeah, I believe that synagogue temple is on Hassel Street.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think they have two rabbis, and the associate rabbi, a good colleague of ours, just they do amazing stuff out there.
Awesome town.
So just to go back in terms of from your training as a physician in Charleston, when you were freshly minted as an MD and started to impart your wisdom and to impart your knowledge on the community, was there a big shift in terms of, you know, studying medicine and now being beyond the study of medicine towards the practice of medicine?
Freshly minted MDs mm-hmm. don't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
What I've learned over the years, mm-hmm. decades, 35 years mm-hmm. practicing, 36 years of practicing, is that good judgment comes from bad judgment, which comes from experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they call it practice.
So right? That's an interesting concept in terms of, I would assume after 35 years of medicine, we've had great successes. We've also had great challenges. How do you as a physician reconcile with yourself when an outcome is less than desirable from what you've seen? Because I can only imagine that must be very difficult in terms of trying to provide the care, the support, and everything else for somebody who may be diagnosed with a very challenging illness. And the outcome and the ability to improve may not be as great as we had anticipated.
You always try to learn mm-hmm. from every case, from every experience. You try to improve techniques. You try to do the best you can. Certainly, not to be blasphemous, we don't play God.
Mm-hmm.
We're not God.
Mm-hmm.
We are doctors mm-hmm. who try our best based on the current knowledge that we have. What's helped over the last several decades, technology has improved.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier access to information. Imagine practicing in a rural community, not having a medical library nearby,
mm-hmm.
and not being able to look things up. 15 years ago, there was no internet. There was no way to look things up like we can now. Now we have instant access to information.
Absolutely.
The other thing that's helped doctors is evidence-based medicine. Are you familiar with that concept?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that for a second.
Sure.
Evidence-based medicine is, I'm only going to do this if I've got a study or experience to show that this treatment works. Years ago, doctors would say, let's try this.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a database to draw from. Now we have all that. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what evidence-based medicine is.
And how much of it, too, in terms of beyond the studies and the reports that get put out by other physicians around the world and certainly around the country, how much do you, as a physician, rely on the expertise of your colleagues in the field?
A lot.
Okay.
A lot, a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of collaboration between, you know, if you're experiencing a patient, for example, that may be struggling with something that may be out of your wheelhouse, to be able to call in another expert in the field to say, educate me, or?
Absolutely. Let me put it in more lay terms.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a dancer?
I am not.
You are not. But you've seen people dance,
right? I have
right?
seen people dance.
It looks pretty easy, doesn't it?
It does.
That's because they know the steps.
Mm-hmm.
It's called muscle memory.
Mm.
If you and I were to get up there and dance, we'd probably be doing a lot of counting in our heads, and it would be a very difficult experience. But people, like on Dancing with the Stars, they just get up there and dance.
Yep.
Because they've practiced it, and that's called muscle memory.
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting given that analogy, because the amount of times I have three daughters at home, and they love gymnastics. They love to watch it from the Olympics to whatever's on TV. And when we see it from the Olympic standpoint, you know, it looks flawless. It looks easy. And what I'd love to see for the Olympics is for them to go through their routine and then to have the average person try and replicate the exact same thing, just to show how difficult it is, because we see it from a very different mind frame. Oh, it looks, I mean, how hard is that? They twirl, they jump in the air. But I think that there's as you say, there's a lot more that's put into it that we just don't see.
Right. Medicine or any level of expertise in any field is the same. And whether you realize it or not, there are four stages of learning.
Hmm.
Let's talk about that for just a second. I like to call it the four stages of competency. The first stage is unconscious incompetence. That's the novice. That's the person that comes in after reading something on the internet for 5 minutes and is an automatic expert. Why? Because they're not. And unconscious incompetence basically tells me I don't know what I don't know. Meaning you know a very little bit about something, but there's a vast amount of material that surrounds those circumstances that you're not even aware of. So that first stage is it's unconscious incompetence.
Do you find within your experience that you find a lot of patients that fall under that trap?
Not a lot, but there are a few who come in and they've done their 5 minutes of homework on the internet. And
because WebMD is the authority.
Right, and certainly chat rooms are much better than 35 years of clinical experience.
Sure. You know, it's always interesting. My brother's I have two brothers that are doctors, and one is a pediatric oncologist. And every now and then I'll say, Adam, I read something. And he said, look, please do not confuse your Google search with my medical degree. And I think that there's a lot of merit in there in terms of the access. As you said, the access to information is much greater than it was before. And to be able to, nail down and be able to say, well, I have this symptom. What is it? And as we know, or hopefully should know, is that that's a microcosm of so much more, but we're so minutely kind of, microscopically looking at one thing that could be so many, and then it just it spirals into something that is just much greater. Wow.
I saw a statement once, and the statement was this, that if I read 2 journal articles a day, every day for a year, at the end of 1 year, I would be 76 years behind in my medical reading. That's wow. how many studies wow. are out there being published. And you read one study, there's another study that contradicts it. I'll give you a perfect example. People with heart disease, fish oil should be a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Folic acid should be a good thing, right?
Mm.
Well, we thought so. And then a study just came out which disproves that, that says that people that take fish oil on a daily basis and people that are on folic acid tended to do worse. They had more morbidity and increased mortality. And we see these all the time. So it's about a system of checks and balances. Mm. And you can't get that from reading on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So that first stage of learning that unconscious incompetence. Mm. I like my patients to have conscious incompetence, which is that second stage of learning, mm. which means I know what I don't know. And that's why I'm here seeing the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I know I have symptoms, but I don't know what these symptoms are. And that's why I'm coming to someone with experience that can tell me what I have.
And what in the event that I, as a patient, come to a physician, I'm unaware of what it is, and the hope and the understanding that my physician will know what it is, but then from the physician point of view, to be able to be in that stage of saying, I'm really unsure of what this is.
Well, you hope that the physician will at least have conscious incompetence, which means that they'll know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And you hope that they'll go to that third stage of learning, which is conscious competence, mm-hmm. which means I know what I know.
Okay.
We want to get to that dancing stage, though, mm-hmm. where you don't have to think about it. That's unconscious competence, meaning I've seen this so many times, I can do it in my sleep.
Sure.
So there's four stages again. Let me just review them. Mm-hmm. Unconscious incompetence. I don't know what I don't know. Conscious incompetence. I know what I don't know. Conscious competence. I know what I know, and unconscious competence, which means I've seen this so many times, I don't even have to think about it.
Have you ever been in the experience where you've been thrown a little bit in terms of diagnosis or illness or the challenge that exists within it in terms of being able to say, you know, what you're experiencing, I haven't experienced before. Let me do my research and my homework and be able to consult with others to be able to get you where, you know, because I think it's a very human thing that we put a lot of our faith and a lot of our trust in professionals, but also, you know, with the understanding that those in professional fields were human. We don't have all the knowledge. I know in you know, from a rabbinic perspective, there have been times throughout, you know, my tenure as a rabbi, where a question has been posed that I don't know the answer. And I think that it's actually quite important to be able to say to the community, I've never thought about that. I appreciate the comment. Let me do my homework because I don't know how to answer that. As opposed to, you know, sugarcoating it and giving some long diatribe and trying to appear to be smart when at the end of the day, we're fishing for answers.
That's why they call it practice.
Mm-hmm. Well,
see, I have a medical practice, and practice makes perfect.
Interesting.
So, yeah, there's a lot we don't know. Mm-hmm. And I tell patients all the time, this is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure what's going on. What you don't want to hear from a physician to a patient is, this is a fascinating case.
Yeah.
You don't, the patient doesn't want to hear that.
Absolutely.
That means the doctor really doesn't know what's going on, and that means the outcome, well, it could be tenuous. So it is a medical practice, mm-hmm. and there is always a learning curve. What I tell medical students that rotate in my office is the day you get your MD degree isn't the day you stop learning, it's the day you start.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because, you know, we tend to say the same thing in Judaic circles of especially that pinnacle life cycle moment where our kids become bar bat mitzvah. Just for those that are unfamiliar, you can't have a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah. You become, because of course in the Hebrew, bar son, bat daughter of a commandment. So you can't have a daughter of a commandment. You become a son or a daughter of a commandment. And what we tend to say to our kids is, may this not be the end of your Jewish education, but may this merely become the beginning. Because ultimately, with religion, it is a lifelong pursuit of knowledge.
You want to make sure that your doctor has a lifelong commitment to learning.
Mm-hmm. And so a lifelong commitment to learning, how does that work for you personally? I mean, requirements based on like the American Medical Association in terms of upkeep with your license, in terms of other professional development, in terms of learning more about the advancements that have been put forward recently? You know, how does that work?
The state of Florida has mandates that in order to keep your license current, you need 40 hours of continuing medical education every 2 years. However, in order to maintain my board certification through the American Board of Family Medicine, the ABFM, I'm required to have 50 hours of continuing medical education every year. So it's 150 in a three-year period, maintain a program called maintenance of certification, and then if I've done that, be reboarded, which is pretty much a seven-hour test every 10 years. And I was just reboarded in 2017, which will carry me through as long as I maintain my CME and maintenance of certification through 2027.
Oh, okay.
Now, am I going to remain boarded after that? I don't know. Am I going to practice after that? I'll be in my 70s.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a really interesting mix to say, okay, I'm going to be tested on the same knowledge that 25-year-olds, 30-year-old, new doctors are being tested on. However, it's almost easier for me to take that test because I've got the clinical experience of having been in practice by then over 40 years, over 40 years. So, it's pretty heavy maintenance of certification and stringent requirements from the American Board of Family Medicine, which are much more stringent than state guidelines.
Interesting. Is there a contradiction within the term board certified? I mean, isn't every physician who practices medicine board certified in order to practice medicine?
No, you don't have to be board certified.
Oh, wow. Okay.
If you've done a residency training program, you are considered board eligible.
Okay.
Which means you've had the requirements in order to sit for boards.
Hmm.
Most hospitals require board certification in order to be on their staff.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be on the staff of a hospital. The only requirement is that you go to medical school to be a physician in the state and have done a one-year internship. You don't even have to do a residency program. Now, I don't know any new physicians coming out that aren't at least board eligible.
Interesting.
And most physicians in this area, I can't say all, are board certified in their specialty. And some of them are grandfathered in, so they only have to take their board certification just one time.
Yeah.
But they still have to maintain a maintain certification, which is called maintenance of certification, which is CME based on their specialty board.
Interesting. So to go back a little bit in terms of, you know, your experience from entering into medical school, post medical school, your practice, practicing medicine itself, and then coming back to this notion of more of a personalized and more of a person to person experience. Have you seen medicine change over the last 30, 40 years in terms of its access towards personal care as opposed to just, you know, I've seen, 500 patients today. I'll see 500 tomorrow. I give my patients, the 4.5 minutes. I think when we had our first child, I think my brother most aptly called it the 450. I didn't really understand what the 450 meant until the doctor came in a rush and realized the 450 is it's 4:50 p.m. I got to be home at 5 o'clock. You're going to get the 40 seconds of interaction. You know, have you noticed that medicine is moving back towards kind of that old school mentality of medicine of seeing the patient where they are, being present with them, and giving them the proper time. And as you said before, as I really like the term, no disrespect to the profession, but to dumb it down in terms of being able to, you know, use the medical jargon in a terminology that is accessible to the average person.
Right. You need to be relatable. You need to be understandable and relatable. If I came in and read you a pathology report and you would say, mm-hmm. What? But if I said, this means you do not have cancer, and this is what they call this particular skin lesion that you have, this is the medication we're going to treat it, and this is how long you need to be on it until mm-hmm. you get better. That's what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. You don't really care what the name of it is. Mm-hmm. You don't really care who named it, why it was named that, et cetera. You just want to know, what do you need to do mm-hmm. to get better? Now, I think medicine's in a state of flux. I think it's in a tremendous state of flux, and I think the pendulum swings both ways. You know, back in the 1980s, everybody wanted to join an HMO, a health maintenance organization, because they were affordable. Mm-hmm. They seemingly provided good care, and large groups like Humana, for instance, came out with these HMOs. Humana has reinvented themselves many times. They've owned hospitals, they've divested. They've owned practices, they've divested. They did HMOs, they divested. Because all these things work for a while and then they don't. Mm-hmm. And what happens in this country is there are so many people. In order to give everyone a modicum of health care, we have to do several things. We have to limit services. Americans don't like it when you limit their services. Mm-hmm. They like it even less when you limit access. So how do you provide good health care? Don't limit access. Don't charge a fortune for it. And seemingly give everybody something they want or deserve. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You cut out the middlemen. Mm-hmm. And who are the middlemen? Mm-hmm. The middlemen are insurance companies, pharmacy benefit providers, accountable care organizations, an alphabet of woe, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm-hmm. If you tell me a medical organization, I can give you a three-letter representation of what they're doing. Accountable care organizations. Accountable to whom? Mm-hmm. Who's it saving money for? Is it saving money for the patient? Maybe. For the physician? Maybe. For the insurance company? Definitely. The whole insurance industry in medicine does not work. Mm-hmm. That's a broad blanket statement, mm-hmm. but let me tell you why it doesn't mm-hmm. work. Because the idea of insurance is that a lot of people buy in to protect a few. Mm-hmm. If everybody had a fire in their house, then your homeowner's insurance would no longer be affordable, mm-hmm. and the insurance company would go out of business. Mm-hmm. Health insurance doesn't work that way. Health insurance is everybody pays in a lot of money, and everybody uses it. Mm-hmm. That's not the idea behind insurance. Insurance is a lot of people pay in for the benefit of a few, and hopefully you'll never need that insurance. Mm-hmm. Life insurance companies would go broke if everybody died, wouldn't they?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
Okay.
No, it's an interesting perspective in terms of looking at it from that way itself.
So let's look at it that way. So everybody needs the insurance. The cost of healthcare delivery is incredible. It's not going to the doctors, guys. You folks, call in. Let's talk about this, because medical providers, doctors, mm-hmm. nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and nurses make up all told, less than 10% of the entire healthcare dollar.
Wow.
Less than 10%, all the providers combined. So where's the other 90% of your money going? A lot of it's going to insurance companies. Layers and layers of administration. Administration. So why does an aspirin cost $10 in a hospital and you can buy a bottle for $3? Mm-hmm. Because it has to be registered in the pharmacy. It has to be given by a nurse. It has to be packaged a certain way. What we do, and you know, I'm on the board of St. Lucie Medical Center, and we look at our care that we give to our patients, and they're on our financial statements every month, on our board reports, there's what's called an EPOB, which is employees per occupied bed. Hmm. So it's not just, I had a nurse. You know, I had a nurse, I had a housekeeper, I had someone from dietary, I had a nursing assistant, I have a physical therapist, the pharmacist is involved. If the doctor is employed by the hospital, he's involved. So you take all the patients combined and all the employees in the hospital, and you look at how many employees there are per occupied bed, not beds in the hospital, because the hospitals aren't always full. And that's how the hospitals partially determine their pricing. Hospital costs are high because insurance costs are high. And if I bill you, let's say, $1,000 for a procedure, the insurance company says to us that's only worth $100, and we're only going to pay 80% of that. So you're getting $80 for a $1,000 procedure.
Wow.
So you're saying, okay, don't charge the $1,000. Can't you guys write it off? No, you don't get to write that off. It just magically goes away because nobody really pays that $1,000. But if you charged less, then the insurance company would say, well, you're only charging $500. So now instead of us paying you $100, we're only going to pay you $50, and we're only going to pay 80% of that $50.
Wow.
So that whole system needs to be revised. We do need a lot more transparency in pricing, and that is forthcoming. We need transparency in pharmaceuticals. We need to lower our pharmaceutical cost. But how do you do that in a country without limiting tort reform? Because millions and millions of dollars go into research and development. In fact, billions of dollars go into research and development. And the NIH, National Institute of Health, doesn't do a lot of research and development anymore. It's all done privately by pharmaceutical companies. So they spend a lot of money doing that. Most drugs that are in research never come to market. It never comes to fruition. And pharmaceutical pricing is based on a drug being brought to market and being patented for X number of years. Now, how do European countries charge so much less for medications? Well, number one, they don't have all the options we have here. Secondly, they don't have the tort system we have here where, gee, I had an allergic reaction to this. It says it on the package insert, but I'm going to sue anyway. Americans are pretty sue happy. And lastly, there's some greed involved. So pharmaceutical benefit companies were supposed to lower the cost of healthcare. They were supposed to lower pharmaceutical pricing. So if I'm a pharmaceutical benefits provider and I'm working for, say, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and you're on a cholesterol medication, and let's say, okay, we're going to put Crestor on this year, which is generic rosuvastatin, but next year we may change that to atorvastatin, which is Lipitor, because we got a better buy on that.
Interesting.
But seemingly the patients don't save any money. And why is that? because it's layers and layers of middle level management in these pharmaceutical benefit companies. Mm. So it's another layer of people that have to be paid.
Yeah.
So the system's a mess. So what I do is I directly contract with you, the mm-hmm. patient. You pay me X number of dollars, and let's just make up a number. Mm-hmm. You pay me $100 a month, mm-hmm. and I'll take care of you. Mm-hmm. And if you need to be hospitalized, your insurance will take care of that. So you can get a higher deductible policy mm-hmm. because you're not paying me a copay. Mm-hmm. I'm outside of your insurance network now. I'm outside of Medicare. I'm outside of Medicaid. Mm-hmm. You just pay me directly. I contract with you to provide you unlimited services mm-hmm. based on what it says in my contract with you. And you buy insurance with a higher deductible, so-called catastrophic care. Mm-hmm. Because you're a young guy. Mm-hmm. Chances are you're not going to need a lot of specialty care. Mm-hmm. And if you do, the money that you would save on insurance mm-hmm. and save by seeing me, mm-hmm. you'd be able to afford to pay that specialist mm-hmm. that higher deductible, maybe $100 copay on that visit or whatever. With me, there is no copay because it's just a contractual arrangement. Mm. So is that concierge medicine? No, that's direct primary care medicine. Mm-hmm. Now, what's the difference between DPC mm-hmm. and concierge medicine? Well, remember, concierge medicine had that connotation that it was for the very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And it started out that way.
When did that whole concept start coming about?
In the late 1980s, early 1990s. Okay. And believe it or not, just like hurricanes, most things hit Florida. Mm-hmm. And it hit the Boca Raton, Miami area. And there was a large company down there. They've done quite well. A company called MDVIP, which was the first in concierge medicine. Hmm. And their price is actually pretty reasonable. They do a nice job. Hmm. But it was initially for a wealthier population. Mm-hmm. It's not that way anymore. And I don't like the term concierge medicine. I like the term DPC medicine because it puts the average Joe mm-hmm. into the picture. Who are most of your patients? The average mm-hmm. Joe. People that work for a living. Mm-hmm. People that want to stay healthy. Walk-in clinics did well for a while, but they're very expensive mm-hmm. because it was the treat them and street them thing. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? You come in, you have a minor problem, I can get you out of the office within an hour and get you back to work the same day. Mm-hmm. Employers love that.
Yeah.
Well, employers should do the same with me. I would love to sign up small companies, groups of 5 or 10 people where the employer can't afford health insurance for these people, mm-hmm. but they can afford to negotiate with me because I can get most patients back to work the same day. And because my patient population is much smaller, you know, the average doctor has between 2,000 and 4,000 patients.
Wow.
The average DPC doctor has between 200 and 400 patients. Mm-hmm. How many patients do I have? I have about 364 patients in my practice. Wow. I want to keep it about right there. But it's a lot more affordable. Concierge medicine also continues to bill insurance mm-hmm. as well as charge a membership fee. That's the difference between concierge medicine and DPC. I don't charge insurance. A concierge doctor has to prove to the federal government that they offer a basket of services above and beyond what a standard practice would offer.
Hmm.
And sometimes that's a little difficult because you're supposed to offer availability, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have to be physician availability. See, when people call me after hours, they get a hold of me.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, let's talk about universal healthcare a little bit. And
so, but it's also interesting, when we first moved down here 5 years ago, I was a newbie to Florida. Had no physician, had no knowledge of where I lived or anything. This was Florida, so it's hot all year round, and I did the as my wife will call it, the bonehead move of wearing sandals in my garage and moving things around.
Well, at least you didn't do the bonehead move of pressure washing your driveway mm-hmm. in sandals. I have seen more cut feet that way.
Oof. I can imagine.
Yeah. It's interesting what comes in.
But it's interesting because, you know, I was moving something and like a ceramic bowl shattered on the ground. A shard went right through my toe. I thought I was okay. The copious amounts of bleeding started happening. Went to lie down, screamed for my wife. My wife, you know, 10 minutes later, saunters in, looks and goes, oh, God, this looks bad. My mother-in-law is has been a nurse for 40 some odd years, 45 years. Looked at it and said, you've got to go to the hospital. So, you know, and a part of me says, do I really need to go? So I go to the hospital. Turned out that it was whatever it was, 4 or 5 stitches. But then the physicians come in. And a part of me that says, please, please, I don't want to talk to you. Because the second you come in, I'm being billed for you to talk to me. And then the nurse comes in. I'm being billed by her. I'm being billed. And suddenly it became overwhelming. Where at the end, I remember saying to my wife, well, I received the bill. 4 stitches, 5 stitches. I mean, it wasn't that bad. It was only $1,800. And a part of me says, $1,800? Are there things that we can do? You know, we see it from a preventable medicine point
right,
of view.
Right. Now, let's say I had a lady. She gets up on a Sunday morning. Nice lady. She makes her husband a cup of coffee. Bends down to get something out of the bottom cabinet. Forgets that the top cabinet's open. And slices her forehead open on the cabinet, on the knob of the cabinet. And she calls me and she goes, what emergency room do you want me to go to? I go, I don't. She goes, what do you mean you don't? I said, nah, meet me at the office. So I said, do me a favor. You know, there's an old axiom in medicine, all bleeding eventually stops. I said, just apply some pressure to it, put a pressure bandage on it. I'm going to finish my coffee, get in the shower. I'll meet you at the office. And I sewed her up. I put in, I think, about 6 stitches in there, 6 sutures. And I don't like to put in dissolvable sutures. I like to put in the non-dissolvable ones because I get to take them out and see how the wound is healing. When you put in dissolvable, patients tend to miss their follow-up visits. What did I charge her for that? Nothing. Because it's part of her monthly membership fee.
Interesting.
So if you see me for X number of dollars a month, and I'm not going to advertise my pricing here on the radio, but if you see me for X number of dollars a month, then all that's included. And that's what DPC medicine is all about. It's a direct contract between the doctor and the patient and establishing a better patient relationship. Now, is that service always available? I mean, certainly I need time off too. I have to take off. But I have coverage when I'm away.
And just to go back a little bit, because I know we're slightly running out of a little bit of time.
Well, this hour has flown by, hasn't it?
I know in the last series that we did a few weeks ago, we just scratched the surface about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of grief. And just, you know, in terms of those stages of acceptance and anger and frustration leading towards that notion of this is me. This is what I have. And being able to really reconcile that as a physician through those stages of grief, do you find that it is within the physician's responsibility and obligation to take the patient through those stages, or that's a personal, I mean, obviously I'm not naive. I know it is a personal, you know, a stage grief development process that is individual, but as a professional to be able to guide and to support one through those processes?
That's a great question, because those processes we used to think were linear. Anger, denial, bargaining, depression/grief, and acceptance, if I remember them correctly. What we realize now, after we've dealt with these for years, is they go back and forth. And that makes it more difficult for the patient to deal with, and more difficult for the physician to deal with. And what it requires is more frequent follow-up. So if I diagnose you with a bad disease, first thing is, you're going to be angry. Mm-hmm. You're going to be you're going to have displaced anger. You're going to be mad at me. Mm-hmm. Don't shoot the messenger. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to deny it. Mm-hmm. This can't be right. I can't possibly have this. Then there's that bargaining phase. Mm-hmm. Who's the bargaining with? God? Mm-hmm. I'll do better. I'll come to synagogue more. I'll come to church more. Mm-hmm. Just please get me better. Mm-hmm. Then God, I'm really depressed. I can't work anymore. And then eventually I accept what I have and I'm going to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And now we know that you can be angry and you can have acceptance, but then you can go back to bargaining and back to denial. And I think frequent follow-up. And a lot of times what you don't want to do is you don't want to interrupt the patient. Mm-hmm. Listening is therapeutic. Mm-hmm. A lot of times when patients have terminal illnesses, they just come in and I let them talk. Mm-hmm. They just want to be heard. Mm-hmm. They want me to know how they feel. Mm-hmm. I can do that because I can spend an hour with patients. Mm-hmm. I can't do that in the 450 visit.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting, you just, you know, from a religious standpoint as well, those stages of grief, because we see, you know, there are times where we will see those who come in looking for spiritual guidance that, you know, certainly are angry at God. Why me? You know, the whole theodicy issue. You know, why I've lived a good and deserving life. Why has God punished me? And, you know, as you said, look, part of it is, you know, I'm not here to solicit and to tell you what to feel. Because that would be a grave disservice to my profession and a grave disservice to what we're trying to accomplish. You know, it is about listening. It's about empathy. It's about understanding. But, you know, have you seen within your profession those stages where one never gets to acceptance and just teeters between the various other stages, going from one stage to the next to falling back to a previous stage, but never getting to that kind of final acceptance?
Yeah, we see that. And thank goodness we don't see it a lot. And that's where palliative medicine and hospice, which is a whole nother talk. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to probably do that talk on my show, mm-hmm. End of Life Issues. But we could come back and do a part three, mm-hmm. because I really want to talk about universal health care, mm-hmm. versus Medicare for All, mm-hmm. and why there's a difference, mm-hmm. and what you out there as a consumer should be looking to buy for your health care and to keep you healthier in the future.
So we can definitely do that as a part three. You know, it would be great to have a priest, a rabbi, and a physician. So when Father Anderson gets back from his missionary work.
And a choir. Let's bring in a choir.
Absolutely. We can do that. You know, but, you know, it's interesting as we wind down and just kind of look at, you know, some of its major issues and some of the major challenges that present itself from a religious and a medicinal kind of outlook. I think part of it from a religious perspective is about informed choice. When you go to a physician, like with every profession in the world, you know, do your homework. And beyond the homework, find for yourself, you know, much like a religious institution. You know, and we say this to a lot of people who come check out the temple, and I'm sure it's the same with our respective churches. You know, you're not buying a pack of gum. You're investing in a spiritual and intellectual group of institutions that are supposed to be meaningful and impactful for you. You know, if we're not the right choice, let us direct you to somewhere where it might be a more fitting, an appropriate place. And I think with medicine, it is, you know, like we say in Jewish circles, you know, acquire yourself a teacher, find yourself a friend. And I think the more that from a medicinal perspective that I can identify with my physician, that I know my physician is empathetic, that my physician understands me and gives me the right time, same thing with religious institution. You know, I think that really is in and of itself, as we say in Reform Judaism, make informed religious choices.
Second opinions are always welcome.
Absolutely. So I thank you, Dr. Perlstein, for joining us this morning. And for those, unfortunately, we did not have much of a chance to entertain some callers, but you can email us, apriestandarabbi@gmail.com. I know Father Anderson is very, very, very excited to receive those emails. So please email us, like us on social media, follow us, and we will see you next time.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to A Priest and a Rabbi podcast. If you haven't done so yet, make sure to subscribe. And please leave a rating and a review, 5-star rating and a positive review if you can. We certainly appreciate it. That is the best way to make sure that others out there just like you can find this podcast. If you want to get in contact with Father Christian and Rabbi Durbin, you can do so by emailing apriestandarabbi@gmail.com. And the absolute best way to get a hold of the fellas is to call into the radio show. This podcast airs live on the radio every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on WSTU 1450. And you can listen live online at WSTU1450.com. And if you want to join the show, you can call in to 772-220-9788. That's 772-220-WSTU.
Hey, everyone. This is Father Christian here on Priest and a Rabbi. So happy for you to be here on this podcast with us. And I want to let you know that I have started a YouTube channel called Your Favorite Christian, and you can check it out on YouTube. And every Monday, I drop a new episode, and it's always through the lens of faith, but taking on different topics such as dating, relationships, marriage, pop culture. I've done one recently where I went out to the art show and talked about how do we find our relationship with God through all the what all the latest artists are doing. Last week was what do women really want in a man, and interviewing different people to be a part of that. So please check that out on YouTube. Subscribe, like, share, put on the notification so you get that every Monday. I also want to let you know of this podcast wouldn't be here if it wasn't for a generous donor from St. Mary's Episcopal Church who wishes to remain anonymous. All he asked, though, was that the information gets out that St. Mary's Episcopal Church here in Stuart has a healing center. And so you can call if you're looking for a counselor, someone to be there for you during a challenging time. And you can call the church at 772-287-3244. We also have a group of Stephen ministers who have been trained over 50 hours of training to be with you and walk with you during a time of crisis. They are not counselors. They are trained just to be more of the presence of Christ and walk with you during a time of crisis, whether it's a good crisis of having, oh my gosh, my daughter's about to get married, or if there's something a little bit heavier. So give us a call, 772-287-3244, and I thank that anonymous donor who makes this all possible.